ಯಶೋದಾನಂದನ ಬ್ರಜ ಜನರಂಜನ ಯಮುನಾ ತೀರವನ ಚಾರಿ ಯಮುನಾ ತೀರವನ ಚಾರಿ ಜಯ ರಾಧಾ ಮಾಧವ ಕುಂಜ ವಿಹಾರಿ ಜಯ ಗೋಪೀ ಜನ ವಲ್ಲಭ ಗಿರಿವರ ಧಾರಿ ಯಶೋದಾನಂದನ ಬ್ರಜ ಜನರಂಜನ ಯಮುನಾ ತೀರವನ ಚಾರಿ ಯಮುನಾ ತೀರವನ ಚಾರಿ ಜಯ ರಾಧಾ ಮಾಧವ ಕುಂಜ ವಿಹಾರಿ ಜಯ ವಿಷ್ಣುಪಾದ ಪರಮಹಂಸ ಪರಿವ್ರಾಜಕಾಚಾರ್ಯ ಅಷ್ಟೋತ್ತರಶತ ಶ್ರೀ ಶ್ರೀಮದ್ ಇಸ್ ಡಿವೈನ್ ಗ್ರೇಸ್ ಏ ಶ್ರೀ ಭಕ್ತಿ ವೇದಾಂತ ಸ್ವಾಮಿ ಶ್ರೀಲ ಪ್ರಭುಪಾದ ಕೀ ಜಯ ಅನಂತಕೋಟಿ ವೈಷ್ಣವ ವೃಂದ ಕೀ ಜಯ ಗ್ರಂಥರಾಜ್ ಶ್ರೀಮದ್ ಭಾಗವತಂ ಕಿ ಜಯ ಆಲ್ ಗ್ಲೋರೀಸ್ ಟು ದಿ ಅಸೆಂಬಲ್ಡ್ ಡಿವೋಟೀಸ್ ಆಲ್ ಗ್ಲೋರೀಸ್ ಟು ದಿ ಅಸೆಂಬಲ್ಡ್ ಡಿವೋಟೀಸ್ ಆಲ್ ಗ್ಲೋರೀಸ್ ಟು ಶ್ರೀ ಶ್ರೀ ಗುರು ಅಂಡ್ ಗೌರಂಗ ನಾರಾಯಣಂ ನಮಸ್ಕೃತ್ಯ ನರಂ ಚೈವ ನರೋತ್ತಮಂ ದೇವಿಂ ಸರಸ್ವತಿಂ ವ್ಯಾಸಂ ತತೋ ಜಯ ಮುದೀರಯೇ ತತೋ ಜಯ ಮುದೀರಯೇತ್ ನಷ್ಟಪ್ರಾಯೇಷ ಭದ್ರೇಷು ನಿತ್ಯಂ ಭಾಗವತ ಸೇವಯ ಭಗವತಿ ಉತ್ತಮ ಶ್ಲೋಕೇ ಭಕ್ತಿರ್ಭವತಿ ನೈಷ್ಠಿಕೀ ಓಂ ನಮೋ ಭಗವತೇ ವಾಸುದೇವಾಯ ಓಂ ನಮೋ ಭಗವತೇ ವಾಸುದೇವಾಯ ಓಂ ನಮೋ ಭಗವತೇ ವಾಸುದೇವಾಯ ಗ್ರಂಥರಾಜ್ ಶ್ರೀಮದ್ ಭಾಗವತಂ ಕ್ಯಾಂಟೋ 9 ಚಾಪ್ಟರ್ 2 ದ ಡೈನಸ್ಟೀಸ್ ಆಫ್ ದ ಸನ್ಸ್ ಆಫ್ ಮನು ಟೆಕ್ಸ್ಟ್ 3 1 ಅಂಡ್ 2 ಡೋಂಟ್ ಹ್ಯಾವ್ ಪುಟ್ ಟೆಕ್ಸ್ಟ್ 3 ಪೃಷಧ್ರಸ್ತು ಮನೋಪುತ್ರೋ ಗೋಪಾಲೋ ಗುರುಣಾ ಕೃತಃ ಪಾಲಯಾಮಾಸ ಗಾಯತ್ತೋ ರಾತ್ರ್ಯಾಂ ವಿರಾಸನವ್ರತಃ ಪೃಷಧ್ರಸ್ತು ಮನೋಪುತ್ರೋ ಗೋಪಾಲೋ ಗುರುಣಾ ಕೃತಃ ಪಾಲಯಾಮಾಸ ಗಾಯತ್ತೋ ರಾತ್ರ್ಯಾಂ ವೀರಾಸನವ್ರತಃ ವೃಷಧ್ರಸ್ತು ಮನೋಪುತ್ರೋ ಗೋಪಾಲೋ ಗುರುಣಾ ಕೃತಃ पालयामास गायतो रात्र्यां वीरासनव्रतः। पृषध्रस्तु मनोपुत्रः गोपालो गुरुणा कृतः पालयामास गायतो रात्र्यां वीरासनव्रतः। लेडीज प्लीज। पृषध्रस्तु मनोपुत्रो गोपालो गुरुणा कृतः पालयामास गायतो रात्र्यां वीरासनव्रतः। पृषध्रस्तु मनोः पुत्रो गोपालो गुरुणा कृतः पालयामास गायतो रात्र्यां वीरासनव्रतः। पृषध्रस्तो मनोपुत्रो गोपालो गुरुणा कृतः पालयामास गायतो रात्र्यां वीरासनव्रतः। Prishadhra tu, among them, Prishadhra, Manoho, of Manu, Putraha, the son, Gopalaha, herding cows, Guruna, by the order of his spiritual master, Krutaha, having been engaged, Palayam Asa, he protected. Gaha, cows. Yattaha, so engaged. Ratriyam, at night. Virasanavrataha, taking the vow of Virasana, standing with a sword. So I'm going to read text 1. Translation 2 and then 3. This is a new chapter. Text number 1. Shukadev Goswami said, thereafter, when his son Sudyumna had thus gone to the forest to accept the order of Vanaprastha, Vaivasvata Manu, Shraddhadeva, being desirous of getting more sons, performed severe austerities on the bank of the Yamuna river for 100 years. Then, because of his desire for sons, the Manu known as Shraddhadeva worshipped the Supreme Lord, the personality of Godhead, the Lord of the demigods. Thus he got 10 sons exactly like himself. Among them all, Ikshvaku was the eldest. Among these sons, today's verse, among these sons, Prushadhra, following the order of his spiritual master, was engaged as a protector of cows. He would stand all night with a sword to give the cows protection. Purport. One who becomes Virasana takes the vow to stand all night with a sword to give protection to the cows. Because Prishadhra was engaged in this way, it is to be understood that he had no dynasty. We can further understand from this vow accepted by Prishadhra how essential it is to protect the cows. Some son of a Kshatriya would take this vow to protect the cows from ferocious animals even at night. What then is to be said of sending cows to the slaughterhouses? This is the most sinful activity in human society. Om Ajnana Timirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chaksur Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Mano Bhishtam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupah Kadamahyam Dadati Svapadantikam Vancha Kalpaturubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasadi Gora Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Hare. So we have begun Canto 9. I'm going to read the summary of the chapter shortly. But in life, before we take on any situation, it is better to be prepared. Because when we are prepared, then whatever comes is not as shocking or disturbing or upsetting giving us some distress. For example, before the onslaught of the Chicago winter, we prepare ourselves physically and mentally. Physically, we make sure we have our socks, our hats, jackets, gloves. And mentally we prepare, oh man, this is Chicago winter, it's going to last for a long time, it's going to be cold, windy, it's going to be inconvenient to go from one place to another, you got to dress up, sit in the car, make sure the heater will turn on. I just have to tolerate because it is Chicago. And even then, when the winter is really bad, we say, oh, it's a Chicago winter. I knew this is how it will be. Similarly, as we progress through the Bhagavatam, the first preparation is to put our phone into vibrate mode. Krishna used Karunanidhi to teach us, but anyway. So as we progress through Bhagavatam, we should be prepared for some real test of faith and be prepared for real shock. Yeah. For example, in the seventh canto, when Narsingadev jumped out of a pillar, it's not as shocking. And when you look at Narsingadev, no one's going to argue that that cannot be God, in the sense that he is very powerful, he's so huge, gigantic, all these claws, fangs. Even Hiranyakashipu for a moment was taken aback when he saw that form. But as we go through the 9th and 10th canto, God appears in the most unassuming form as Lord Ram, Krishna, Balaram, and they do very human-like things. They get married, they argue with their wives, steal butter, get into politics, fight a war, take the side of their friends. It seems partial. Lord Ram does things that really bewilders the mind like anything. Plus, this ninth canto is full of very, really, really kind of situations. The previous chapter, who in the world knew Sudyumna would walk into a forest and suddenly his gender would change? This is like already a shocking, wow. Riding his horse, he was this very powerful young king. He rides his horse and the next moment he finds himself as a very attractive woman. It's like, what happened? I just entered a forest and that's all, you know, like that. And then because it is Lord Shiva's, statement, on one side, on the other side, there is Lord Vishnu's blessings that he'll be a, you know, he'll be a boy because he was born as a girl. Can you imagine the amount of identity crisis the guy would have to go through? Born as a girl, Ila, changed to Sudyumna, walks into a forest, becomes a girl. And for the rest of his life, each month, you change your genders. Like, this month, I'm a man. This month, I'm a woman. Hare Krishna. Very fascinating. Fascinating like anything. So that's one, to be prepared. Prepare yourselves, or let's prepare ourselves, for one shock after the other in the ninth canto. It's coming. More stories coming. In fact, this Prishadra story is one of those. Is one of my favorite stories in the entire Bhagavatam. I've narrated this story many times here. And we hear the details of this. So that's one. This Prishadra story. So that's one point. Second point, there are some really wonderful life lessons from the story of Prishadra. It is interesting that the first son that was born to Shraddhadeva, his name is Ikshvaku. And Ikshvaku was such an amazing king that his glory was so widespread that the entire lineage that came after that was called the Ikshvaku dynasty. When one person's name is given to the entire lineage, that means they're very great. One king, Yadu, whole lineage was called Yadavas. Ikshvaku. It was because of King Ikshvaku that Lord Ram appeared in that line as a glorification of that lineage. As a glorification of Maharaj Yadu, Lord Krishna appeared in that lineage. So they don't speak of word Ikshvaku as much as they speak of Prishadra. Prishadra had no dynasty, meaning he didn't have a kingdom. He was one of the 10 sons, but his story is being discussed. There must be a reason. Because although he didn't have a kingdom to rule upon, there must be some wonderful quality that Shukadeva Goswami wants to narrate. Right? He didn't say, here, let me tell you about Ikshvaku and start out a whole pastime of Maharaj Ikshvaku. He quickly moves to Prishadra, the very next verse. Why? Because he did something very fantastic. So it's an important lesson for us as hearers of Bhagavatam. Very, very critical lesson. It's coming up. I won't spoil the, suspense. So that's the second thing. And the third thing, important when we're studying Bhagavatam. When we come in contact with the teachings of Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavatam, every one of us has what I like to call certain biases. Okay? And these biases, they come or they're there because of our past. And because of, mostly past, but this is how it manifests. A bias means we look at the Bhagavatam and its teachings from a false ego perspective. When we read Bhagavatam, we're reading it from a false ego perspective, generally, because we're not free of the bodily designation yet. At least I'm not. So we have these biases, such as, I am a woman, so when I read Bhagavatam and it says something about women, then I get disturbed. Why is the women like this? For example, Shraddha Deva, for all the yajna he performed, he got a girl. He was happy, but then his determination was to get a boy. So when a woman reads it, she might think, well, girls are so bad, or what? What's the problem with this? Huh? This is how you treat women. That's a bias. Another bias would be, if Sudyumna's, this is just example, if Sudyumna's gender's changing, because I'm a man, my view of the persons who change gender, especially in the Bhagavatam context, I'm not talking modern context, Bhagavatam context, then we think, what's going on? Is this right? Is this how it should be? Why Lord Shiva had to say everyone should become a woman? What's that? Or certain cultural biases. I read it as an American, I read it as an Indian, with certain cultural context. I read it as a young man, I read it as a brahmachari, I read it as a grihastha, I read it as an intellectual person looking at Bhagavatam, thinking these stories sound so mythological. Are they even true? Are they symbolic? Should I extract something symbolic out of this? These are all called biases. And when we study Bhagavatam with bias, then we don't get from it what it is wanting to give us. So it's very important to recognize what those biases might be and set them aside. It's not an easy task while we study Bhagavatam to keep our biases aside. It's very difficult. Yet, that is our motivation and purpose. And read it and study it from a very non-judgmental perspective. Because when we judge it, and we do judge every situation in our life, when we come across it, the judgment is when the questions such as, why like this, why like that, why not like this, if I were in that situation, I would do it like this. That those are judgments of it. Because there are some obvious things. For example, let's just pick an example. Dhruva Maharaj's case. Maharaj Uttanapada was sitting on the throne. Uttama was sitting on his lap. Dhruva comes running. Daddy, daddy, can I get on your lap? And Suniti and Suruchi, the two wives, are standing there. Dhruva is the son of Suniti. Uttama is the son of Suruchi. And Suruchi says, no, you cannot, because you were not born from me. And Dhruva feels very sad. Maharaj Uttanapada doesn't say a word. Suniti did not argue. Later, the two women did not have a cat fight. We might say, if I were in that situation, I would have talked to Maharaj Uttanapada and say, Saab, buddy, it's a little kid. We would have given him a little counseling. Send him to a grihastha seminar, a parenting seminar, or got Suniti and said, you're a woman, stand up for your rights. How can you be like this? So what if you're the younger queen? This is the modern world. Something. We would approach the problem differently. Because that's how we live our lives. And then we wonder, why? Why did they do it this way? Why not the other way? Why not that way? Why not this way? So those are all our biases. We bring our cultural, our modern context, our past, our experiences, our gender, our ego designations into studying Bhagavatam, and those are stumbling blocks. So the third point is connected to the first. Be ready for shocks. I mean, this is going to get even more. In this pastime, Prishadra, for doing something really wonderful, gets a very horrendous outcome. He gets cursed very badly for something that he didn't even... And when we read the story, it's very obvious he has not done anything wrong. Yet, that's just life. And how these people accept life as it comes to them. That's the appreciation in this pastime. Okay? Let me read the chapter summary. And if the story is already there, then we'll narrate it. This second chapter describes the dynasties of the sons of Manu, headed by Kurusha. After Sudyumna accepted the order of Vanaprastha and departed for the forest, Vaivaswata Manu, being desirous of sons, worshipped the Supreme Personality of Godhead and begot 10 sons like Maharaj Ikshvaku, all of whom were like their father. One of these sons, Prishadra, was engaged in the duty of protecting cows at night with a sword in his hand. Following the order of his spiritual master, he would stand in this way for the entire night. He didn't sit down and doze off. He would stand all night protecting the cows. Once, in the darkness of night, a tiger seized a cow from the cowshed. And when Prishadra came to know this, he took a sword in his hand and followed the tiger. So, let me read it. I was going to narrate it for you. Unfortunately, when he finally approached the tiger, he could not distinguish between the cow and the tiger in the dark. And thus he killed the cow. Because of this, his spiritual master cursed him to take birth in a Shudra family. But Prishadra practiced mystic yoga, and in bhakti yoga he worshipped the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Then he voluntarily entered a blazing forest fire, thus relinquishing his material body and going back home, back to Godhead. Kavi, the youngest son of Manu, was a great devotee of the Supreme Personality of Godhead from his very childhood. From Manu's son known as Kurusha, a set of Kshatriyas known as Karushas were generated. Manu also had a son known as Dhrushta, from whom another sect of Kshatriyas was generated. But although they were born of one who had qualities of a Kshatriya, they became Brahmanas. From Nriga, we hear of Nriga somewhere? Where? Krishna book, this king who got cursed to become a lizard. Imagine, one son got cursed to be a woman, another one got cursed to be a Shudra, then some became Brahmanas, another got cursed to be a lizard. Imagine what Vaivasvata Manu must be going through. From Nriga, another son of Manu, came the sons and grandsons known as Sumati, Bhuta Jyoti and Vasu. From Vasu in succession came Pratika, and from him came Oghavan. Descending in order from the seminal dynasty of Narishyanta, another son of Manu were Chitrasena, Ruksha, Midhavan, Purna, Indrasena, Vitihotra, Satyashrava, Urushrava, Devadatta and Agniveshya. From the Kshatriya known as Agniveshya came the celebrated Brahmana dynasty known as Agniveshayana. From the seminal dynasty of Dishta came sons of Manu. Another son of Manu came Nabhaga, and from him in succession came Bhalanda, Vataspriti, Pramshu, Pramati, Kanitra, Chakshusha, Vivimshati, Rambha, खनिनेत्र, करंधम, आविक्षित, मरुत, दम, राज्यवर्धन, सुधृति, नर, केवल, दुंधुमान, वेगवान, बुध एंड तृणबिंदु. In this way, many sons and grandsons were born in this dynasty. From Trinabindu came a daughter named Ilavila, from whom Kuvera took birth. Trinabindu also had three sons named Vishala, Shunyabandhu, and Dhumraketu. The son of Vishala was Hemachandra, his son was Dhumraksha, and his son was Samyama. The sons of Samyama were Devaja and Krishasva. Krishasva's son, Somadatta, performed an Ashwamedha sacrifice, and by worshipping the Supreme Personality of Godhead Vishnu, he achieved the supreme perfection of going back home, back to Godhead. So, by tomorrow morning, I would like all of you to remember all these names. Okay? I thought of narrating the story of Prishadra, but we're going to read it anyway. Maybe I'll prepare you for what to look for as the story comes up. Okay? Just to highlight it. So this young man, Prishadra, he took on this service called Virasana Vrata. Virasana means to stand with a sword in hand, alert. Vira means a hero. And asana means a position or pose. So he stood in the pose of a hero. And the purpose was to protect cows. For any king or brahmana, their wealth is the cows. Generally we think wealth is currency notes. It's, you know what a currency note is made out of? Not paper, cotton. And you print on it. Previously, a country would print only that much currency that was equal in value to the gold that they had. So that note had some value because it was associated with the gold that was in reserve. Now, it has nothing to do with gold. They just decide, let's print a few more millions of $100 notes out in the market. It has nothing to do with gold as a reserve or as a basis. So it's paper or cotton. But it was the understanding that a person would have wealth if they had cows roaming their land. Because real wealth comes from the ground. And the ground becomes fertile only when there is cow dung. Otherwise it's not fertile. That's why you find deserts. Wherever cows pasture, that's where the land is rich. And they understood that the cow and land and wealth are completely interconnected. And therefore they took care of cows. Here's another connection. Cows give milk, so do buffaloes and goats. Right? Camels too. But we never hear a Vedic yagya performed with camel milk, a yagya performed with goat milk. No, only with cow milk. Because cow milk, there's a long story about cows and all that, but anyway, cow milk is the ideal for ghee. And that ghee is necessary for yagya. What happens when you perform yagya? What happens in Bengal? You please Lord Vishnu. What else happens in the Bhagavad Gita? Come on. You get rain. Because the demigods and Vishnu are pleased, you get rain. Without rain, no grain. No rain, no grain. No grain, no brain. Simple. They're all connected. So, no grain, no rain, no rain, no grain, no brain. Because without Anna, one's body is not nourished. It's required. And grain only comes from the ground, and it doesn't come because the farmer tilled the land. Of course, he did his part. But it comes because ultimately Lord Vishnu and the demigods have to bestow their mercy in the form of rain. So the system is that yajna brings rain. And for yajna, you need grain. So it's a cycle. It's an integrated system. That the grain you get, you offer back. It's that system of, you want to call it gratitude, you want to call whatever you want to call it as. It's a system that when you get from nature, by the mercy of Krishna, whatever you get from nature is given back to Krishna. If one follows that system, then one's life is filled with abundance. But if the system one follows is that whatever nature gives, or whatever Krishna gives through nature, one takes and doesn't give back, then one doesn't live a life of abundance. One lives a life of abundance of fear. That's the only one thing that comes in abundance, is fear and anxiety. That's just the system. So to recognize that and to appreciate that and follow that is in our own best interest. Otherwise we fight a system that we can't win over. It's as simple as that. And in this whole system, cows play the most significant role. And so every king and Brahmin would know that if they took care of their cows, then their land is full of abundance, of wealth, happiness, goods, everything is full. So Mr. Prashadra took on the service of protecting the cows. And at those times they didn't have lights, floodlights and all of that. So one night, it was a very dark night. There were clouds in the sky, not enough light, the moon was not shining. So it was pitch dark. In Chicago, we don't understand the concept of pitch dark for two reasons. One, that the air is so polluted that there is always a cloud of pollution. And when we have so many lights that reflect from, or that are glowing on the streets, that light gets reflected from the clouds. Therefore, even if you go out at night and look up to the sky, you can't see stars. Unless you go to a place like Gita Nagari or some rural place where the air is not so polluted, you can look up in the sky and it is a most fascinating view. It's filled with stars. Filled with stars. So we can't see, but when in the area that he was and the times that they were in, it was such, everything was pure and clean. The sky was dark. It was pitch dark. In the middle of the night, a tiger attacked the barn. And there was a skirmish. All the cows were running helter-skelter. They were mooing. And there was a lot of commotion. In that commotion, he had to protect the cows. And he heard the roar of a tiger. And he couldn't discern. And he saw the tiger and he's very quickly tried to kill the tiger. But in that swoosh, and it was in the dark, that instead of killing the tiger, he killed a cow, the very animal that he was trying to protect. And it was not that he wanted to kill the cows. In fact, it was the most well-intentioned act. If any of us were to be in the situation, I shouldn't ask the question, because we would run away when we hear about a tiger. So anyway, so I can't say if we were there, what would we have done? We would have ran. So anyway, Krishnadev did not run. So forget that I asked the question. If your friend was there, what would you have said for them to do? Should have stood there, taken care of the situation. So in the best of intentions, he tried to protect the cow, unfortunately killed the cow. Sometimes we want to do something very well intentioned for someone we like, it actually turns around and may hurt them. It was unintentional, but that's what happened. Next day, his guru, Vasishtha, saw the situation and cursed him. You behaved like a Shudra, you killed a cow. I curse you to take birth as a Shudra. As soon as we hear that, the first thing is a protest, right? Internally at least. What? And Vasishtha is not an ordinary two-bit Brahmin who doesn't know what he's talking about. Vasishtha is the son of Brahma, who was born from the mind of Brahma, was the guru for the entire Ikshvaku dynasty. He's so aged, I shouldn't say aged, he's so experienced and wise, that from the time of Ikshvaku he's been guiding them down to Dasarath and to Lord Ram. And we would ask, Vasishtha cannot think properly? What's going on? He can't think straight? Why should he curse Prashatra? There's no explanation given why. So our biases were like, come on. He paid, when we read news, right? Some guy was sent to prison for a crime he did not commit. He spent 9 years in jail, 10 years in jail, whatever. He did not commit that crime. But the judge passed a judgment. Similarly, this Brahmin sentenced him to be cursed. I mean, cursed him to be born in a Shudra family. And you know what Prashadra did when he was cursed? Do you know what he did? Karunanidhi, you know what he did? What do you think he did? What do you think he did? He just stood quietly and accepted it, did not protest. So this ninth canto, we will find personalities who don't protest when something very unfair happens to them. What's his name? Prashadra is in this situation. Next coming up is, after that, King Ambarish, Maharaj Ambarish. Had a little sip of a drop of water. He didn't even chug down like a whole water bottle. 2-3 drops of water. And he was cursed to die by one of the greatest sages in the universe. Next, one more story comes. Just one after the other. Lord Ram is also here. All happy, getting ready for coronation the next morning. Everyone so jubilant. He gets word at night, no coronation, out to the forest please, tomorrow morning, go. Like a major turnaround, no protest. Ambarish Maharaj, no protest. Prashadra, no protest. And other stories. So what is it about these persons that when they are put in honestly, very unfair situations. It's not like, okay, philosophically we can debate it. It's obvious. It was unfair. By all means of logic and rationality, it was unfair. They accepted it. What is it? What is it about them that they accepted? Because somehow or the other, they saw the divine intervention of Krishna in it. Now, how they saw is very difficult for us to explain, because again, we will look at it from our perspective and say, oh, I won't do it like that. What's wrong if I were to do, is it okay if I were to do like this? Is it okay if I would? Answer is yes for all of that. But from their perspective, what is it that they saw and did not protest? Something, there is some devotional quality to a very, very strong degree that makes them not protest. And that's why we glorify them in the Bhagavatam. So, any comments? This is just very, very high level, because I didn't want to spoil the rest of the specifics of that will come up in the pastime. And I also intentionally did not get into the whole cow protection thing, but yes.
Thank you, Prabhu. It's wonderful point of the lessons that you were bringing, preparing us for this whole canto, in terms of, you said, preparing for shock. And as part of our naturally growing in Krishna consciousness, you know, there's going to be situations that we find it shocking, yeah, sometimes. And for example, we may be, because we're looking through our lenses, as you put it out, we think, oh, everything is very clear, everything is very nice, everything is in place. But all of a sudden, what you find in coming at you is, and actually confronting you, is like, no, it's not okay. Actually, it's not acceptable. Or it has to be changed. Or like that, you know, we're confronting these things. And then you have to, obviously, the first reaction, as you say, is like, wait a minute. No. You know, you try to defend that thing that you have, you know, that conception that you have. So how, I mean, what's the best way? Obviously, you have to, you presented the examples of these devotees that had, you know, very elevated approach to it and Krishna consciousness, and they were able to deal with it without protesting at all. In the situation of most of us, you know, is not a simple thing to actually just all of a sudden change. So what would you say, you know, some advice on that, you know, dealing with the shock of confronting that, you know, there's not necessarily things are as smooth as we would like it to be?
I have two things to say. One is, there are different degrees of shock. For any person, what is the most, not the most, what is the dearmost thing in the world that at any cost we will not give that up? What's the dearmost thing? One's wife? No, they're happy to give that up. One's own life. At any cost, Prabhupada says, uses a Sanskrit phrase, that one will always, always, always preserve one's own life. And one will do anything to preserve it. For example, I'm just going to take you through a hypothetical situation. Okay? We find ourselves in the middle of a desert. There's nothing, we haven't eaten in a week. We haven't drank water in a week. Somehow, miraculously, we're still alive. And if some creature walks by, would you be interested in eating it or no? We won't say, oh wow, I can't eat that. It's because hypothetical, because our answer may not come from full realization. It may come theoretically, oh, it's not prasadam, I will not eat it. Maybe. But if our life depended on it, But if we didn't eat, we would die. Some persons may say, I'd rather die. Which is fine. That's their realization. Some persons may think, I'd rather be alive. It's very difficult to give up one's life. Very, very difficult. Especially when one's life is threatened. That's why Prabhupada says that you see, even if you cut down a tree, somewhere one little shoot will come out. Because it always wants to preserve life. You pull it a fence, the tree will work around the fence. Every living entity is only doing one thing, preserving life. Because that's our real nature, we are alive, we are eternal beings. So death is not natural to us. So anytime there is death, we try to avert it. That's just the nature. And these persons are cursed to die. It's the greatest difficulty they're put in. It's not that you lose all your kingdom. It's okay, at least I have my life. We always come to that conclusion, okay, at least I have my life. In this case, the shock is very eternal. I mean, very, very intense. Die. So when we get shocked, we go back to, at least my life's there. It's, you know, okay, I don't like the situation. It's shocking this way, that way. At least the worst case scenario, if I consider, I'm alive. I'd rather be alive. So that's the perspective to look at. Okay, it's not life and death. Some things are shocking. They're not life and death, though. So always compare to, at least I would say right now, think of, hey, it's not life and death. Okay. This thing happened, that thing happened. It's not life and death. That's one. Second, in this world, if we know how this world operates, it's easier to live in it. Correct? It's called, for those of us who attended the 24 Gurus seminar, there was a phrase we called it, Tattva Lakshana. You're somewhere there. Tattva is good. There's one word here and one word there. Loka Tattva. And the other word? Vichakshana. Loka Tattva Vichakshana. Means the ability to see and understand the mechanics of this world. If you know it, you're not disturbed by it. If you don't know it, you're constantly surprised. Constantly surprised. This is how the world operates. For example, the seasons change. If I know that, I look forward to spring. I know that. Winter will come. Isn't that the first lesson in Bhagavad Gita also? Happiness and distress come and go. They come and go. They then come. Happiness doesn't come because I say happiness, distress. Where? We'll be disappointed. And Krishna says, as they come and go, just tolerate. Be sober, keep going. Keep going means perform your whatever duties you have on hand. So in this world, there are certain things, certain phenomena where there's always some tension. There is tension means there's one force pulling this way, another force pulling that way. This world is full of such equilibrium or such forces acting. For example, one of the forces is mercy and justice. When to be merciful, when to provide some justice, punishment. There's always this tension. You ever find yourself in that? When to punish and when to forgive? This is that tension's there. And sometimes we lean this way, sometimes we lean that way, whatever it is. But that tension's always there in life. That's one. Second is how much to just accept as this is providence versus I need to take action. Anyone found yourself in that dilemma? When to say providence versus act on it? That tension's always there. And it's not easy to resolve. In fact, we find contradictory instructions. When Arjuna was at the, for example, on the brink of battle, he decides, I just say that this is providential arrangement. This is how things were supposed to be. Just let it go and not fight. Krishna says, don't be a fool. Fight. Right? Previously, when he was in the position of Lord Ram, and he was told, go to the forest, he said, I'll accept it as providential arrangement. And there's a beautiful two chapters, a conversation between Lord Ram and Lakshmana. Lord Ram takes the position of, this is providential arrangement. And one should learn to recognize what arrangement the providentially has been made and just accept it and don't complain. That's Lord Ram's stance. Lakshman says, come on. According to Dharma, you should be the king. This is unfair. You're a Kshatriya. It is your duty to fight something that's unjust. Is on this side. And this whole dialogue is that tension. Lord Ram doesn't move from that position. But when it came to Krishna, he says, go fight. So when to accept and when to act? We don't know. It's not easy. And Krishna says, and Krishna accepts it in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 4. It's in the section of transcendental knowledge. He says, kim karoti, kim akaroti. What to do, what not to do. Kavayo api atra mohitaha. Even the greatest thoughtful persons are bewildered about it. What's the right action? We don't know. Draupadi is being disrobed. Bhishmadev, Drona, Vidur, all the great persons are sitting there. They didn't say anything. They didn't know, should I say, should I not say? Is this the right thing to do? Is it not the right? Although internally they know, this is not fair. But they're caught in that dilemma, they're caught in that tension. So what to do? The answer is not always clear. Unless the whole thing is seen from Krishna consciousness perspective. And for each of us, our Krishna consciousness allows only the amount of insight in proportion to our Krishna consciousness. That's what it is. So someone here will see it differently, someone here will see it differently, someone here will see it totally differently. And that's okay. Because life is individual to us, each one of us. What's applicable and how I see and act will be very different from how you see and act. That's just how it is. So an answer is not always clear. So it requires us to be able to go and transcend that those forces, that tension, to see it from the point of view of service. So then the question is, as a service to Krishna, how do I respond to this situation? That's the only way to break that tension. And here's the surprise part. I told you, be ready, right? Our understanding and interpretation of what is service will also be very different. So we do the best we can and learn from it. The day we stop learning, we're finished. So we may make what we call mistakes, but we're supposed to learn. As long as we're ready to learn, there is more enrichment possible. So what happens to us naturally, I shouldn't say, what happens to us generally is we find ourselves right in the middle of that tension, this way or that way, and we're stuck there. And that is the most horrendous, frustrating situation to be in, indecisiveness. Anyone been in the situation where you're not able to decide? Oh my gosh, it's the worst place to be in. It's the worst place to be in, right? Because this side looks perfectly okay, and then we have the yeah, but this side also looks perfectly okay. That's just how it is. And this is where the Bhagavad Gita is also. The first chapter, Arjuna Vishada Yoga. Arjuna's indecisiveness. He's stuck right in the middle. Don't know what to do. Paralyzed. So the whole Bhagavad Gita is see it from the point of view of service. If I am a servant of Krishna, what am I supposed to do that will enhance my service to Krishna? Let me do that. Then even if the decision is supposedly wrong, there's no right or wrong, even if it were, because it is done from the vantage point of service, Krishna's intervention comes in a very special way. That's the only way to break the tie. For asking the question, what should I do as a service, our ego position is that of a servant. So that means we're free of the bias. Otherwise, in the middle of that tension, our false ego is operating. I am such and such, I am such, whatever it is, and that's where we don't know how to break the tie. Am I just blabbering or am I making sense? Yes? Okay. Long-winded answer, but that's my current thought.
The phrase, a man is situated according to his knowledge. The person in a mode of ignorance doesn't know what to do and what not to do. And then there was an example of a child, and the devotee said, just see, the children are so innocent. And Prabhupada said, they're supposed to become intelligent.
Right.
So he said they need training. And then he was in New York, and he saw somebody getting beat up or something, Srila Prabhupada, and he said, oh, wow, people are, you know, just walking by and somebody's getting attacked and they don't do anything. So that's pretty prevalent. And then somebody's lying on the street and people are just walking by, you know, not, you know, taking care of the person. So they don't know what to do and what not to do. So it's so pervasive, you know.
Right.
So these are just some things that came to my mind, you know.
Yeah, thank you.
Hare Krishna, I was appreciating your point at the beginning of the class that when we read the Gita or Bhagavad Gita, we read it through bias, particularly use the example of if you see something sets is apparently, then we become all frustrated. And the reason I appreciate the point, because it reminds me when I was 5 years old, someone stuck their middle finger at me. And I was completely undisturbed because I didn't know what it means. And usually the tendency is, I guess as far as this pastime is concerned, it mentions that although the king was trying to protect the cow or hurt the cow. So my question is related to that point is that usually when parents try to protect their children, they say you're a woman. Therefore, if anyone says anything about women, or if you're Black, African-American, then you should become depressed. You should become fearful, angry. And as children, we didn't even know what these words meant, and we're completely happy. And so, or if you somebody insults you in a different language, just recently Jitendra told me him and Basu Ghosh went to some Indian place, and someone started insulting them in Hindi, and Basu Ghosh, they didn't know Basu Ghosh knew Hindi. And so that's the tendencies, but it's very difficult. That's the tendencies that, how can one protect oneself from one's thoughts when you're in a provoking situation? You may not physically attack someone, verbally attack them, but your mind is attacking them. And it's like unlearning a language. It's impossible to unlearn a language and to get rid of our false ego. So how are we supposed to maintain our enthusiasm and Christian consciousness when it's like impossible to unlearn the language?
Well, if we are honest, then we accept that, you know, right now my ego is very hurt. And because my ego is very hurt, whatever I say and do will be detrimental even further. So I need to shift my position from false ego to true ego before I say and do anything, although my mind is racing. So luckily in Kali Yuga, we're not punished for all the thoughts. We're punished for those thoughts that become actions, or rewarded for those thoughts that become actions. So as long as it sits in the mind, it gives us the time to, or supposedly gives us the time to think about it. So Ambarish and all that, as they're coming, these great personalities, although they were insulted to die and attacked, die, they didn't budge from the position of being fixed as a servant of Krishna. Savai mana Krishna padaravindayo. That's the verse that's repeated again and again and again by Prabhupada. Vachamsi vaikuntha gunanu varnane. So he used all his senses in staying fixed in that position, and he looked at things from that position. So when that's the case, what's a attack on life? What is it? Nothing. It's the fearless position, but not arrogantly fearless. Ha, Durvasamani, you can curse what you like. You know, I am a servant of Vishnu, I'm fearless. Watch out, Sudarshan Chakra is going to be on your back. Fearless, but humbly fearless, not the other way. That's just what it is. Yes, Mataji, you have something.
What you just described, Nityananda Pran, of the tension that's is there from being in a position where one has to make a decision, and the decision could be such that one sides with one's ego, or perhaps not. So if sometimes somebody is presenting something where they're perceiving that there's tension, and the tendency is to look at the either the fault of somebody else, or that the situation is incorrect, that there must be a better situation elsewhere, that things are not arranged properly for one because one is siding with the ego. Or in fact, one may even be thinking of an action to go and harm somebody else in some way in order to resolve one's tension. So in those kind of situations, it's often very difficult to have a person try and see the consequences of their action, or see the consequence of siding with the false ego, that, you know, some sort of destruction, detrimental consequence will be there, because the persons are in that state of tension, but clearly they already tending to side a little with the false ego. So in that kind of situation, what would be helpful to help a person diffuse some of that attachment to the false ego?
Most persons, or all of us, as rational beings, we always want to take the right decision. So we're always stuck between right and wrong. Is that the right decision? Is that a wrong decision? So one of the ways to break that is to understand that there is no right or wrong decision. It's just a decision, and there, whatever the consequences of that decision. Therefore, Bhaktivinoda Thakur describes everything as favorable to service and unfavorable to service, or one's relationship. That's how he characterizes them. So it's more important for a person to make a decision to do something than to stay stuck and suffer. So when a person can't see the consequences, when one is taken down the path. Okay, let's say you take this decision, you have two choices, you take this choice. What do you think, or what do you foresee will be the outcomes? Okay, here are all the outcomes. How do you feel about that? If you take this decision, here are all the outcomes. What do you feel about these? Which one can you live with? They won't be ideal. Which one can you live with? So most people will say, I want this decision, but I want that outcome. That's just how we are. So it's a matter of just taking them down, and then you take this art of decision making. It's not easy. You take one step, in one direction. See how it goes. Not the whole thing, just the one step. See how it goes. Feels okay? Take another step. So instead of one decision, it is then broken down into smaller decisions. You start somewhere. But just to break that tie, otherwise it's very, very difficult. The person agonizes in that stuck position. Like Arjuna is stuck. I found myself in that position many times, stuck. Thank you very much. Śrīla Prabhupāda ki jai, Śrīmad Bhāgavatam ki jai. Gaura Prema Nanda.